Hey, I'm Saji Wickramasekara, and this is Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. My guest, Patrick Hsu, knows what it means to chase big ideas. From starting college at 15 to pioneering CRISPR as a grad student, he's never been afraid of standing out from the crowd. Since then, Patrick's launched one of the world's largest open-source machine learning models, started multiple companies, and co-founded the ARC Institute, all while making big, fundamental discoveries that move science forward. Patrick, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. It's always great to see you.
We've known each other for, we were just discussing, more than 12 years now.
Time flies.
I know.
Yeah. But you look the same.
Yeah. I was going to say, you look the same. You haven't aged a day.
That's extremely kind. In fact, in my lab, they tell me I might be aging backward.
Well, if we have time, we'll get to your skincare routine at the end of this.
Great. No spoilers.
Yeah. Let's actually start to back when I met you, when you were in Fung's lab at the Broad Institute. So you're a grad student in Feng Zhang's lab. You were working on CRISPR genome editing before CRISPR was a, you know, household term. It's a household term right now.
I hope so.
Yeah.
You tell me.
I think so.
We'll run a survey.
Do you remember a singular moment when it became obvious that CRISPR technology was going to go on to have such rapid and far-reaching impact? Like, take us back to the early days of CRISPR.
Well, I would say, maybe I'll describe two moments. The first is when it saved my PhD.
Okay. Was your PhD not going well? I find that very hard to believe.
Well, I spent 2 years doing Golden Gate assembly of tau effectors, which was the previous genome editing technology you know, involved clicking together proteins like Lego blocks. And, you know, this was pretty painful. And so I was a deep believer in CRISPR from the beginning, mostly because I could go from, you know, these multi-hour Golden Gate assemblies that I would run until 2 a.m. every day to just ordering an oligo from IDT and reprogramming my, you know, my genome editing enzyme. That really changed my life, which is really what I cared about at the time.
You know? Okay. So you're working on something different you're working on genome editing, but you weren't necessarily working on CRISPR specifically.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was working on zinc fingers and talons, you know, long before CRISPR.
The OG gene editing tools.
Yeah. I mean, this is back in, you know, 2011, right? Okay. When we, you know, working on a whole bunch of other things at the time. In fact, you know, ostensibly, and in fact, I would say Fung catfished me because it was a neuroscience lab, right?
And that's true. He was in McGovern.
Yeah, at the McGovern Institute and at the Broad. And, you know, if you went to his website at the time and read all his papers, they're all neuroscience papers.
Okay, so you were interested in neuroscience. Okay.
I wanted to study, you know, learning and memory, right? And that was actually why I became a scientist, was to try to understand neurodegeneration and hopefully develop treatments. And I ended up going there to try to understand the epigenetics of the memory engram, to understand how memories are molecularly written into the brain. And the idea was that we would take these tau effectors, fuse them to DNA methyltransferases, and use them to methylate and silence or epigenetically modify specific genes that might be involved in memory circuit formation. And, you know, that was what I thought I was going to be doing in my PhD.
Okay.
It ended up being, of course, quite different.
Yeah.
And that led me on a 15-year detour or tangent from, but now at ARC, we're getting back to Alzheimer's disease, which is great.
Okay.
Yeah, but it took some time.
What was the second moment? So the first moment is helped save your PhD because you went from these, you know, grueling cloning experiments to something that was fast and simple. What was the other moment where you knew CRISPR was going to be big?
Yeah, so that was the moment when seeing how well this stuff worked in the lab was the big unlock, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was an unlock for me personally. And I was like, oh, wow, this is something that's going to be rapidly adopted. Other people are going to hopefully want to use this. So the second time was I was invited to give a talk by some postdocs at Harvard Medical School about this CRISPR stuff that they had been hearing about. I'd say this is...
Were there papers published on CRISPR at this point, or was it more just like rumor mill?
This was the end of 2013.
Okay.
So the papers had come out, right? folks were, you know, it was a thing people talked about in the water cooler. But I, of course, was in lab all the time, so I wasn't part of any of these conversations. Right? You know, we were, you know, actually building this stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't being very social at the time.
So you went and did this talk for a bunch of other grad students.
Right. So they invited me to give this talk. You know, I take the T, you know, go over to Boston. You know, give the talk in Longwood, and the room was so packed that they had to call the fire marshal.
Wow.
And, you know, that
doesn't happen a lot for grad student seminars, does it?
It was, I wasn't sure what was going on. At first I thought maybe I'm in the wrong room, right? But, you know, it was you know, that's when I realized people cared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it was like was the uptake of CRISPR as like rapid as you expected?
I don't think I expected it.
Okay.
Right? You know, we were interested in these problems and thought that they would be a useful tool, but after we would publish each paper, we created this assembly line in the lab where we would, you know, furiously aliquot a bunch of plasmids, you know, color code them, cut these strip tubes, and then package them into UPS packages, right? Yeah, because there were just hundreds of requests coming in week on week.
Oh, and, this is like pre,
you know, this
pre-agene,
okay. Right? You know, pre just, you know, put your stuff on the internet, and then people can just, you know, acquire it for free with a universal MTA that's just a one click sign, right? You know, we had to actually mail things out of, you know, our own grants to, you know, get these in people's hands.
And, that's wild.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
Let's talk more about Fung's lab. So I think the Zhang lab is known for being incredibly prolific, and for pursuing kind of really big ideas that have had, you know, industry-wide impact. I think they've spawned a lot of successful biotech companies as well. I think it's more than happenstance that's the case. Can you tell me more about Fung's management style? I feel like, and his leadership style, I feel like that's actually like understudied.
I was one of the first people in the lab, right? I think
he's first grad student.
No, that was Le, Neville, Silvana, then me. And yeah, so I was one of the first four people in the lab, in the initial cohort, right? And, you know, I think, I did, when I was doing my rotations, I did the thing that I think most Harvard PhD students do, which is go rotate with the most senior, famous person possible. And, you know,
who else did you rotate with?
I won't name names because I found those rotations very uninspiring.
Okay.
And, you know, and then I, you know, ended up at the Broad in Fung's lab actually kind of randomly via collaboration, right? Mm. Where I was supposed to go there and learn how to make tails and then, you know, go back. And I never left, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I'll tell you two things that I first noticed. The first was, on every bench in the lab, there was this, you know, multi-liter glass beaker. It was like a 2-liter or 4-liter beaker on the bench, right? And that's where you're supposed to put your pipette tips. Right?
Yep.
Now in the lab I had just come from, what we had were these little orange and yellow racks where you would fit a tiny biohazard bag that's maybe the size of my palm, right? And that's where you would put your tips. Right. And so, you know, you're basically seeing this 10 to 100x increase subliminally in the output that you're expected to produce experimentally. Right. And that was my first kind of sign that I couldn't articulate back then, but just there was this vibe of productivity.
Okay.
And, you know, it just sort of was, you know, that was just the energy that oozed in the lab.
Did Fung ever make it explicit or?
Never.
Never.
Never. Yeah. Those are just the signs that I was interpreting like I was on a field trip, right? Maybe. Anthropologically, this is what must happen.
Maybe Fung gave me some tips for our employees.
Yeah. Yeah, or mine. Yeah. Right? But no. I think that was one of my kind of very first signs. I was like, oh, this place might be a little different.
Okay.
Little did I know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think he was very young at the time. Fung started his lab when he was 29, I think.
Okay.
Right? And so his bench was actually next to mine.
Oh, he's still doing bench work.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I don't know if people know this, he actually did a lot of bench work. In fact, he did almost as much bench work as his students.
Wow. Okay.
Which, at least in the first few years of the lab, which is kind of scary because I then, you know, realized he was doing all these other things. right? Like being a PI and teaching a class and writing 25 grants his first year and, you know, publishing all these other papers. And so, you know, I don't know where he found all this time to do all these things while, you know, competing with me on mini preps, right? Yeah.
That's amazing. So another subliminal sign.
Yeah. I hope Fung won't mind me telling the story. I remember, you know, one night it was like 1 a.m. and I was like, hey, Fung. He's like, what's up, Patrick? And I say, hey, you know, you see me more than your wife, right? You know, what's up with that? and then he looks at me, you know, Fung is very, very patient and gives me a smile and is like, she understands.
What about his, I noticed the lab has like a rich history of collaboration amongst the students in the lab too. Is there anything you could share about that and how it worked, how he encouraged that across grad students? You know, a lot of labs end up with a dynamic where it's actually a little bit more competitive and potentially less than healthy dynamic. And while I'm sure the folks in the Zhang lab were very competitive, it always struck me as a very like productive and healthy environment for collaboration.
Yeah, I would say two things. The first is, you know, most traditional academic projects, even in very high-powered labs, right, you kind of need lead authors because you're optimizing for being first author of your Nature paper or whatever, right?
Yep.
And I would say that Gordian knot of incentives, by the way, is, you know, I think pretty problematic. And one of the things that I've long felt science publishing could really easily fix is this, you know, kind of co-first author model where, you know, it should, you know, we should figure out a way to represent the co-first author designation in papers and in PubMed and in Google Scholar and on the journal websites in a way that makes it very clear that these are actually equal contributions, because I think that will incentivize a lot more collaboration by making these contributions really visible. Because right now you have to click into it and then read this really esoteric kind of author information, and no one does that. But I would say the way that we did it in the lab was really a case of convergent evolution.
Okay.
Right? Basically, you know, the field was extremely fast-paced. It was very exciting, but also quite stressful. And so in order to, I think, survive, right, and make sure that your work or your project could actually get executed on, you know, just on time, right, you would need to try to band up with other people in order to, you know.
So was the collaboration kind of just an emergent property where you and the other grad students?
I think
students,
so. Okay. Yeah. And I think folks would work in these small teams and, you know, they're sort of like SEAL teams on individual projects where folks would sort of self-assemble, right? Sort of like individual cells or sort of self-assemble into, you know, pairs that would lead individual projects. Now, the key thing is, in order for that model to work, you actually need multiple papers so that you can switch off on the next paper.
Okay.
Right? And so this model, I think, doesn't work when there's only one paper to be had. But given the pace of the field and the energy, especially in the early days, I think people would publish not just one or even two, but three or four or five papers together.
Which is very unusual for a lab in grad. Okay, so there was like a mentality that like, hey, like you'll be first author this time and I'll be first author next time. And like everyone in the lab knew that was the case and it functioned because of that.
Yeah, and revisions, you know, I would say an even larger team would come and kind of pile in and help, you know, fill out those stories.
Right? Interesting. So it's like almost like the lab was a team.
Yeah. No, and I didn't realize until later how unique and special that was. Yeah.
Is there anything else Fung did that uniquely cultivated that kind of teamwork, or is it just his work ethic plus, you know, the lab being focused in a very like fertile area for science?
Yeah. Absolutely, I would say. I don't know the right kind of historical figure to analogize this to, but you know, he was one of those generals who leads from the front, right? He's sort of in the trenches with you, especially and definitely in those early days, right? Obviously the lab and, you know, career stage is in a very different place now, but at the time, you know, I was a very hardworking graduate student, but the one thing I knew was no matter how hard I was working, Fung was working harder.
Yeah.
And that really impressed me.
That's probably inspiring.
Yeah, that really impressed me.
I respect that.
Yeah.
So like I think, you know, over the last 15 years and probably more, is like it feels like you've always had your kind of finger on the next big technological innovation that's going to move biomedical research forward, whether that's CRISPR in the 2010s or AI and machine learning today. I guess, like, how do you identify those watershed technologies or breakthroughs early on? I mean, it sounds like CRISPR was a little bit like you were there and in the lab, but like ML probably wasn't like that, right? How did you come onto ML?
Yeah, you know, on the CRISPR point, one of the interesting things a few years later was I read a grant that Fung had written, like one of the first grants that he wrote about CRISPR. And, you know, he wrote in this grant all of the things that you might be able to do with this technology and all the different kind of applications in, you know, genetic medicine.
This is years after
your
possible. PhD.
No, this was towards the end of graduate school.
Okay.
It was just, you know, in some like Dropbox that we had at the time. And, you know, I was kind of poking around, you know, these Dropboxes before we really knew how to share files really well. And
no,
you know,
permissions,
so I,
back then.
Yeah, so I just kind of happened on this thing that I probably wasn't supposed to have access to. And I remember reading it and seeing the blueprint of the last 4 years written in this document from years past.
Wow, so he had the vision.
He had the vision from the beginning. And what I realized was, you know, CRISPR was actually the third important technology that Fung had worked on, right? Before that, in his PhD, he co-invented optogenetics.
Yeah.
With Carl Dysrath. He was Xiaowei Zhuang's first graduate student, undergraduate student at Harvard. And so he had a front row seat to the invention of storm microscopy, which is super resolution microscopy, right? Which was also a Nobel Prize winning technology. And so, you know, he had actually seen two fundamental important biotechnological advances before his turn as a junior PI to make his own mark. And
wow.
So that pattern matching, that pre-training, right, allows you to find those patterns.
Oh, that's amazing. So by the time he was 29, he'd been through sort of two of those
waves.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then he got the third, right, which is even bigger than the first two.
Yeah, so it's quite different from, I think, you would even normally as a kind of young hotshot assistant professor or whatever might expect, right?
And so the answer here, like in the business of science or the art of science at least, it's you think it's like pattern matching and apprenticeship around the greats can really help.
You know, these days, I think education, you know, is really focused on scaling, right? Mm-hmm. How can you give as good of an education to as many people as possible?
Mm-hmm.
But I think graduate school is one of the few bastions of the old world way of doing education. It's like master and apprentice, right? And it's still very much like a guild, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to, you know, kind of advance on to the next step, you need the approbation of your seniors, and you sort of, you know, kind of watch and learn and observe someone who, you know, is an expert in what you're doing, right? It's like a guild. And I think there is clearly a tremendous amount of taste and latent knowledge and ways of attacking and deconstructing a problem that get transferred. Some PIs teach this explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do it implicitly through their own work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your role as a student to
learn. Yeah.
And then learn how to generalize out of distribution for your own work, right? And, you know, to the extent that, I certainly couldn't have articulated any of this like that back then, but I try to be much more explicit about these kinds of things with my trainees now.
Wow. There's been a lot of talk lately of Chinese biotechs and how they've been able to reduce their cost basis and develop drugs faster. What do you think is going to be the critical factor for lowering cost basis in the rest of the world in the US, and how do you think like AI and machine learning could be part of that for American science?
Yeah, I went to China late last year.
Tell us about your trip.
You know, to go check it out. First of all, the capabilities are incredible and they're very real, right? And, you know, I'll say a few things, right? I have a friend of mine who runs one of the largest CDMOs in China, but they're not the largest.
Okay.
Right. And they wanted to be the largest CDMO. So they hired a bunch of managers from this other competitor company that they want to emulate.
How'd that work out?
Right. And, you know, after a few months, those new managers came and came to talk to the CEO, and he's like, we have to talk. And he's like, what's going on? And he's like, well, you know, we need to talk about working hours. guy's like, "What do you? Well, we all work 9-9-6."
Yeah, I was just gonna say,
right?
Yeah,
we're doing good, right? He's like, "No, at this other company, right? They you know, we work until 11 p.m. every night, right?" And so the next day they had a, you know,
9-11-6 doesn't have the same ring.
Doesn't have the same ring. But I think that just gives you a sense of what we're up against
in China. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say it's like, it's vertically integrated there. You know, they're hungrier, right? Their cost basis is lower and they're playing to their strengths. Right. And I think our strengths here are different, right? Mm-hmm. They're not working 9-9-6 or 9-11-6 or 9-11-7, right? They're not, you know, biomanufacturing. We can try to onshore chip manufacturing here. We can try to onshore, you know, biologics manufacturing. I tend to think that's, you know, probably not where America will find the most alpha. Mm-hmm. I think we're strong at innovation, right? I think, you know, I think it's a reasonable hope that, you know, AI will be able to bring down, you know, certain cost bases for drug discovery significantly. Mm-hmm. I think virtual cells will be able to do this. If we are able to make models or world models of cells or tissue response that are good enough that we can actually do in silico target ID and, you know, kind of toxicity or whatever.
Sure. That's a 10x drop in cost basis right
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's what we need to lean into. Mm-hmm. I think we need to lean into differentiated data, mm-hmm. our ability to generate unique proprietary data sets that are actually fit for model training, mm-hmm. right? Actually train models and eval them in effective ways and actually use that to increase industry probability of success. The good thing is it's quite low right now.
Yeah. So, the only one way to go is up.
Yeah. The only way hopefully is to go up. Right? Yeah. And even 10% or even a 2x to 20% probability of success, which is still sounds very low.
Yeah.
Right. Would transform a lot about not just how we make drugs and funnel them, but I think also how we think about early stage investment.
Sure, the cost basis wouldn't matter so much if the success rate were higher, right? Because like the patient impact of these medicines is so big.
Yeah, there are more drugs that make $1 billion in revenue a year than tech companies.
Is that true? Right? I didn't know that.
I read on Twitter, so
okay.
Must be true.
Yeah, it must be true. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's go three.
I might hallucinate. We are entering the era of AI agents. Which parts of R&D or the scientific method do you think are best suited for AI today? And where do you think the industry is going to get the quickest ROI first?
I think faculty in the academic setting are now using AI to help them write grants, right?
Are the grant reviewers also using AI to read the grants?
Well, you know, that's funny. Funny you say that because I recently received a review for a paper I submitted at an unnamed, very high-profile journal that was clearly written by AI. And in fact, it was
lots of M dashes. They delved into your work.
They delved deeply into my work with highly organized subheaders, right? You know, it's the M dashes and the headers,
yeah.
Right? When they provide you this nice, concise little summary at the beginning of each statement,
yeah.
And it was like 4 pages of.
Was it a good review?
It was very verbose.
Okay.
Very verbose, which is another sign.
Okay.
But anyways, It was sort of like a denial of peer review service attack, right? It was like, let me just tell you all the things you need to do. I imagine the prompt was, give me something that'll take them as long as possible to do. But anyways, like I think models will be really effective for the regulatory sciences.
Sure.
Actually.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, hopefully we can, you know, streamline and improve the, you know, bureaucracy of the regulatory process. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that a lot of folks hope and some are actually working on, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, having models that can fit, kind of the key content to, you know, extremely complicated review processes will, I think, really improve efficiency of the system, right? I think we have to sort of remember the size of R and the size of D, right? Mm-hmm. In R&D, lots of folks are really focused on de novo design and mini binders and making a trillion molecules.
Sure, but that's just like the very, very beginning of the process.
You got to do the development.
Yep.
Yeah, right. So, you know, I think one interesting question is, will we really have predictive models of tox? Right.
Mm. Will or even when?
If will or when. Hmm. I think if you have a predictive model of talks, over that basically converges to a model of all biology, right? Because you need to predict how different cells will respond to a drug, how different tissues will respond, mm-hmm. and then how they'll actually interact in order to give you systemic tox. And so it's one thing to be able to predict whether certain liver markers will go up. That's narrowly fine, I think. But actual tox modeling, so that...
That's like the holy grail.
Yeah, that's the holy grail, I think. Mm. Yeah.
In other interviews, you sort of said we're somewhere between GPT-1 and GPT-4 when it comes to AI for biology. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us like what that means and, you know, where on the spectrum do you grade us now, and what can we learn from, like, how can we get to GPT level 4 maturity more quickly?
Yeah. You know, biology is really complicated.
I agree.
Yeah. It's hard to just even read the papers in the first place, right?
But now we have GPT to help us read the papers.
But it doesn't do a good enough job. I think it helps you get to 70% understanding. Mm-hmm. But it consistently falls short for the last 30%. Hmm. In fact, when you ask the latest models, whether that's O3 or 2.5 Pro or O4 Mini or whatever, I think this interview will get rapidly dated, right? you know, the...
Just name a bigger number in a scene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 09. And you ask it, you know, what are the most important problems I should be working on, right? What are the most important breakthroughs that will happen in the life sciences in the next decade, right? It actually gives you incredibly boring answers.
Oh, interesting. Right? Okay.
In my opinion, that's my hot take for the day.
Okay.
Right. And so I think they're really missing this taste and this gestalt somehow. And
the models didn't have an apprenticeship in the guild.
I think providing them more, like, it is an interesting question. Like, what are the right labels that you would need to give it the guild feedback, right? And actually have it, you know, teach you something interesting, right? But I mean, just to be clear, I'm very positive about AI and science.
Mm-hmm.
They're clear. Like, I think agents are going to clearly automate all bioinformatics, right? And you know, once we can connect these to robots so that they can do agentic lab in the loop, it just feels obvious. Hopefully we'll be the beneficiaries of the humanoid wars, right? And you just get some arms that can hold some pipettes. Yeah. That would make me a very happy man.
Yeah. The arms will work 9/11/6/7.
Hopefully more.
Yeah, 24/7. When people criticize AI models for hallucinating, I've heard you say, I think hallucinations from strong models will eventually be a major driver of scientific progress. Mm. Scientists hallucinate for a living. This is basically the creative process. Can you unpack that?
Well, when I think about how I ideate or the folks that I admire or have trained with or trained or got trained by, right? Just like the very best people are doing like high temperature inference and generation of ideas, and they're kind of playing with concepts that cross boundaries, or they've been able to extract deep insights from some subtle data pattern that everyone else who is also looking at that slide just didn't see, right? You know, just like when someone in a talk or in a lab meeting asks a super insightful question, right?
That afterwards seems really obvious, but no one thinks of it beforehand.
Right, but that's what the biggest discoveries are, mm-hmm. right? That they're actually very obvious. And the reason why they're big discoveries and the reason why they're obvious are actually two sides of the same coin. In order to reach really big impact, right, I think it needs to solve something that everybody wants, mm-hmm. right? And, so, you know, I think the tools that everybody uses, whether that's BLAST for sequence alignment, sounds very primitive today, CRISPR for gene editing, AlphaFold for structure prediction, mm-hmm. right? I think, hopefully one day folks are using virtual cell models and digital twin models to just say, hey, if I, you know,
perturb this, what's going to happen?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, that would be so magical if that were possible today. But for them, it'll be like an annoying thing they have to do before they can get dinner that night. Right. Yeah. So I think hallucination, right, to get back to your question, is, you know, you know, you're basically taking all of these ideas that are jumbled in your latent space mm-hmm. and pulling them into token space. And initially they sound weird and crazy, mm-hmm. but when you shape them in the right way and you trim these flowers to make your Ikebana, it actually becomes a banger discovery, right? And that's the process.
Yeah. It makes a lot of metaphors there. That's good. I'd be remiss not to mention Evo 2, obviously. I believe it's the largest biology machine learning model ever trained, 9.3 trillion nucleotides from over 128,000 whole genomes. I get that right?
Yeah.
Who's counting? It can identify whether a mutation is disease-causing, and it can even design new genomes. So it's a huge accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's an amazing team.
And so it's also one of the largest open source machine learning models in any category, period. Academia is a little bit, can be more sort of secretive. I think the life science industry is a little more secretive by nature, whereas open source is just a lot more common in sort of the tech world. Can you elaborate on the motivations behind making Evo 2 totally open source? And, mm-hmm. you know, what discoveries or downstream innovation do you want to see others use it for?
So most open source models, and you know, there are lots of open source natural or vision models, yep. right? Natural language models, and you know, those aren't actually truly open source models, right? You know, they might release the weights, they might be an open weights model, mm-hmm. but they won't release the actual data that they use to train the model, or oftentimes they won't release the training infra, right? Mm-hmm. Or the inference stack that's actually used to actually operate or make the model, right? Yep. And, you know, that is actually where I think these companies find their alpha, right? Is
okay.
in the training data mix or in the post-training strategy. And, you know, what we try to do with UO2 was to make basically everything that we used open, right? The pre-training data, it's online, you can download it, right? The pre-training infra, it's on our GitHub, right? The models on Hugging Face, right? And folks can use it fully openly for scientific research, right? And I think if you look at the pace of progress in the field, one of the things that you see is this tension between doing basic science and discovery and industrial engineering and scaling, mm-hmm. right? You see this both in the life sciences industry and then also just in general AI.
Yep.
Right. And reducing the difficulty of actually training large models at, you know, kind of, you know, tens of billions of parameters, you know, is something that, you know, today is not easily accessible.
Nope.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we want to, you know, provide that for people using kind of battle tested infra.
So is the desire to be open source, is that just because of kind of ARC's nonprofit kind of mission, or was it ever a question to go closed source or to be only open weights? Like, what was the decision-making process to go fully open for everything?
We think there should be more models and more models of biology.
So people need
particular.
To learn from what you did.
Yeah, yeah. And so folks need a way to bootstrap.
Okay.
And there aren't that many folks training large biology models. Mm. Why? Part of it is GPU access, but an even more serious part is the lack of MLEs and,
yep.
you know, infra that actually works to make these models.
Okay, so you hope you can kickstart something in the industry to and people will build off what you've done.
Yeah, we want more of this stuff.
Yeah. So it seems like we're in an inflection point and for a lot of reasons when it comes to research. Let's start at the science itself. Traditionally, hypothesis-driven research is very targeted and mechanistic, but as automation and robotics make it easier to generate large-scale data sets and ML models get better, hypothesis-free research driven by large-scale profiling becomes more feasible. We see that now with ARC's newly released Virtual Cell Atlas. Congrats again, by the way. Lots of product launches. It's been described.
Team has been busy.
Yeah, it's been described as ImageNet for cell biology. It's the largest open source resource for single cell transcriptomic data, including data from over 300 million unique cells. That is a lot of cells. Is more data the answer? Are the days of hypothesis driven research over, or do you see them as equivalent approaches?
I think they all converge over time, right? I think. One of the interesting things about research is, especially the culture of the life sciences industries, everyone's obsessed with my data, right?
Yep.
My data is proprietary. It's my own data asset. No one else has it. It's really special.
You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Every biotech company, everyone says their data is super valuable, but you don't see data transacting very much.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is deeply cultural somehow, mm-hmm. right? And by the way, this data is also why my model will be better, right? You know, your model doesn't have this special data stream, and so it's just going to be fundamentally weak in X and Y and Z eval, right? Yep. And so I'm a little bit concerned by how much this culture is now being directly ported into the AI bio culture. Mm. And I think it's really important that as a community, we try to break it, because otherwise we're going to be deeply subscale on all of the data assets that we need for anyone to succeed at all. And I think people are playing these, like, I don't know, just like local optimization games.
Sure. Yeah.
And the global optimization is that we break biology open, and that we do so in an open science federated approach in order to actually win. Others, you know, it's sort of like how, you know, equity, if equity grows, everyone wins.
Yeah, right? Make the pie bigger.
Right, make the pie bigger. If the models work, then everyone will win, right? Yeah. Because fundamentally, people don't want to be doing experiments at the very basic gory level that they're happening today, right? We want to be able to program and manipulate and model biology at higher levels of abstraction.
Sure, and that's gonna it's like the Jevons paradox or whatever, and like the demand for biology and people's desire to tinker with it is only going to go up if the barriers go way down.
Yeah, and that's what people are saying about GPUs, right? And why we need to build even bigger compute farms. And time will tell if that's true, right? Maybe 99% of Earth's power draw will all come from data centers soon, and so we of course have to solve nuclear fusion.
Yeah.
But I just think that's so clearly true in biology.
Yeah.
We want rational medicines that are based on mechanism. If you look at TREM2, for example, which mm-hmm. is a prominent human genetics hit for Alzheimer's disease, there are drugs going into clinical trials where one is an agonist and one is an antagonist, right? That just shows you.
And we have no idea which one's going to work.
We have no idea which one's going to work.
We're just guessing.
Right. Yeah. That's a state of play today.
Yeah. That's hard. Speaking of convergence, you're at this like interesting intersection where I feel like you're kind of bilingual in both the life sciences world and the tech world. You're working on AI grants with Nat Friedman. You spend a lot of time with tech startups. In fact, I think you might spend more time with tech startups than I do, even though I run a tech startup.
Benchling's not a startup. Yeah. Big company.
Oh, is that a compliment or pejorative?
Always a compliment. Yeah.
Can you tell me, like, how did you start getting involved with tech? And then how has that made you a better scientist?
Mm. Yeah. It's a really interesting question. How is easy. I grew up here. I moved here in high school. I'm Canadian originally, but I moved to Palo Alto when I was 14. And there's just a certain cultural osmosis that happens when you're in the area.
So you got a little bit of the tech bug before you went to grad school.
Oh yeah, I don't have, by the way, like doctors and professors in my family, mm-hmm. and ending up as a professor and the wrong kind of doctor was basically the opposite of my early life plan, the kind that can't help people, and so that's definitely not what I wanted, and mm-hmm. I was very interested in figuring out how to start a biotech company after my PhD. This was in 2014.
Yep.
Right. It was 11 years ago. And, there were very few options for doing that. In fact, I interviewed at a few different places.
Like some of the venture creation places.
The sort of known venture creation shops in the Boston area who were like, maybe you should go get an MBA. Right.
And is that why you ended up joining the founding team of Editas? At least get some on the ground experience in a biotech company.
I wanted to see what it looked like. And it was very interesting to see how it was done, because it had a very clear playbook that they had, it was a well-worn, well-established, highly opinionated playbook about how to do it that was diametrically opposed to the way it's done in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And I found that extremely interesting. And maybe you could actually say the next decade of my life involved trying to figure out the differences and the convergences between these two very different models, right?
And so when did you kind of post Salk, you started spending a lot more time in the tech world? Like how did AI grants with Nat happen?
I first got interested in the business models actually, of how tech companies work, because they're, you know, classic real businesses, right? Mm-hmm. You need to make something that people want. You need to find customers and iterate with them, and you need to crazily make money, right? This is actually very different from how a biotech company gets built.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You know, you have a fancy schmancy board and scientific advisory board. You've established, battle-tested pharma and, you know, kind of biotech-derived management, mm-hmm. right? You have a platform that leads to a pipeline of assets, and then you pump in a huge amount of money into it and then try to take it public, right?
Yep.
And, you know, that was sort of the well-worn playbook. And if you, I think the way to think about why this happens is actually fairly explainable by, you know, like LP incentives. Actually, sure. So if you're in a university endowment and you need to allocate $1 billion into Sequoia, mm-hmm. or into some, you know, biotech fund, right? Why would you allocate money into the biotech fund over, you know, one of the, you know, the top firms and the most well-performing asset class in history, mm-hmm. right? And you'll, you know, the reason why you do that is twofold, right? One is, you know, kind of like, you know,
diversification,
right? Spreading your bets across different industries. But another reason that GPs figured out was faster timelines to liquidity.
Yep.
Right. And, you know, that fundamentally explains a lot about the venture creation model and incentives that, mm-hmm. you know, downstream affects how everyone operates.
Yep. Right?
And you don't realize this until later in your career.
Yep.
Right. And, you know,
it affects in tech too, but yeah.
The effect is in tech, but it's much stronger in biotech.
I believe that.
Yeah.
What lessons do you think that biotech companies should learn from tech companies?
Yeah. So a lot of what I do, interestingly, right, by kind of living in both worlds, is think about the strengths and weaknesses and histories and vagaries of these different industries and models and why they happen, and figure out how you can take lessons horizontally from across mm-hmm. them to do good, right? Or, you know, survive or whatever. And, you know, so I'll give you a few examples, right? I think a lot of researchers don't really think about product, right? They think about papers
and technology,
or they think about technology, or assets, right? Mm. You'll be really focused on making an antibody asset or something like that, right? Or delivering a specific IND enabling data package or some GLP tox study, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's much less of a sense of product, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if, you know, GLP-1s have created more value than all biotech startups combined over the last 30 years.
That might be my one of my favorite stats.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just crazy, right?
Yeah.
And that's just, if you think about it, it actually it falls out of the simplicity of the product, right? And I think, you know, way more pharmas would be spending much more of their R&D budget on these, you know, very asymmetric bets than they are today.
Totally. I think GLP-1s are very interesting because there's just no way that some analyst in some spreadsheet was like, yeah, this thing's going to be bigger than all the last 30 years of biotech startups. I think everyone was like caught by surprise. And I hope it's made the biotech industry dream a little bit bigger.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. It's a long rolling average, right? Yeah. Given how long it takes to read out the differences, right? I feel like a lot of the dynamics of the biotech market get smoothed out by this kind of 8-year rolling time average. Yeah.
Hmm. Let's talk about funding. The ARC Institute itself is based on a model that disrupts traditional funding models. Can you explain some of the motivations behind co-founding ARC and taking a different approach to funding?
When you get a bunch of scientists together to brainstorm breakthrough blue sky ideas, you know, and then they come up with an idea that they want to work on together, what happens next?
They talk about grants.
They go and write a grant together. Yep. What happens next? They send it to the government and they wait, right? What happens next? Your grant gets rejected. What happens next? You get the grant and then you go hire people and do it, right? And so this is just actually what happens today. And so the time scale between ideation to starting on the project is insane, mm-hmm. right? And we basically thought, what would it look like if we brought in folks together across disciplines under a single physical roof who want to work together and have the organizational structure that frees them to simply just go and do stuff, right? And, you know, today investigators don't investigate that much. They're
write grants. Yeah.
They're doing a whole bunch of other things, including writing grants, right? They're doing administrative things, serving on committees. You know, you have to, you know, raise money for your lab, but you also have to go and recruit people and give talks and then, you know, write papers and reviews and do peer review for free. And, you know, you're just busy. And
not doing science.
Yeah, not doing science. And, you know, we wanted a place that's focused on science, where people are collaborating together, where they're thematically stitched together in the right way. And we wanted to balance the curiosity-driven discovery engine of the academic model, which is what makes it great, mm-hmm. with the engineering and scaling capabilities of the technical staff model, mm-hmm. right? Which is what makes industry, right? Whether in the AI industry or the biotech industry, great, right? And bring those two elements together under a single physical roof to actually solve flagship scientific projects that you wouldn't be able to tackle with individual labs or individual companies, right?
Is it kind of like, does it rhyme with like Bell Labs or anything like that for you?
You know, lots of folks talk about Bell Labs, and certainly as a student of history and of science history in particular, mm-hmm. We've studied the Bell Labs model deeply. The one thing I'll say about Bell Labs is they almost famously were very poor at thinking through the applications of these fundamental discoveries and insights. We'd love to avoid that fate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think from a product and application point of view, we spend a lot of time thinking about how these things get out of the lab and don't end up as nature or science papers or whatever, but actually help people in the real world. Yeah.
What lessons have you learned from the last few years at ARC that could be applied to other public funding models? Or, you know, what are the roles of different funding models, and are there clear winners when it comes to efficiency?
Yeah. Because we were able to start something new, we were able to rewire the operations of the Institute from the ground up because we built it from scratch. Mm-hmm. And so,
Has there been anything like ARC before?
You know, lots of folks have pattern matches for what they think ARC is, right? And we certainly have studied carefully the models of institutes and research organizations that came before us, whether in biology like Rockefeller and Salk and Scripps and Broad and Whitehead and Genelia and what have you, to outside of biology, you know, like Bell Labs or DeepMind or, you know, and so on and so forth, right? But I think, you know, we're 4 years in or less, right? And it's certainly very early days, but we do think there are early signs of the model hopefully working to produce interesting, important contributions that don't feel like they could have been done anywhere else, right? That they are like ARC-like projects that are unusually interdisciplinary and, you know, have a certain kind of taste around the types of problems that we like solving. And we'd like to just show more examples of that over time. I've always said that the ultimate success of anything like ARC or whatever would be that folks try to make more of them, right? And I think private capital can only ever model new ideas, but it, you know, the overall NIH system, right, which, you know, spends, you know, $40 to $50 billion on basic science funding a year, which is more than the next 5+ countries combined, right? You know, I mean, that's just whatever ARC spends is a tiny drop in the bucket, right? But, you know,
so it'd be awesome if there were 50 more ARCs.
I think that would be extremely exciting and make me very bullish about innovation and progress.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your personal life.
Let's go for it.
All right. You started college at 15, and you started your own lab at the Salk, no less, at 22. Whereas most academics are not, if they're lucky, starting up and exceptional, starting their lab to their, you know, mid 30s. Since then, you've made seminal discoveries, you've launched companies, you've built an institute. What do you think it is that drew you so early to discovery and disruption through technology? Like, when did you know you wanted to be a scientist?
I first started working in a proper university wet lab when I was 14.
Okay.
And 2 weeks in, I think, I knew I loved it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah,
I knew I loved it. And it's not clear to me that it was that I loved what I was doing in the lab per se, but that
what were you doing? Do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I was in a lab studying the molecular and cell biology of deafness.
Deafness. Right? Okay.
And I cut my teeth on single cell patch clamp. And
what is that?
It's a way of recording from cells. So this is a long-winded story, but basically you have these specialized sensory cells in the cochlea of your ear,
sure,
that do mechanotransduction from sound waves to electrical signals that go to your brain.
So you can
when
hear.
These
yep.
cells die, they're called hair cells. When they die, you go deaf, right? And we were basically trying to figure out what's going on with these cells, what's in their specialized sort of membrane microvilli called stereocilia, and how do they get damaged in deafness. And
okay.
I was basically studying this process,
yep.
right? And
how does a 14-year-old end up in a deafness lab?
You beg.
Okay.
Right, you beg.
So you had some curiosity to experience what it'd be like to go. You had some interest in research.
I was trying. So I was homeschooled until college.
Yep.
I had grown up in this, you know, kind of habit of trying to find interesting projects to do. And then eventually I was like, well, it would be fun to try some research, mm-hmm. right? So I emailed 50 professors at the local university. 49 of whom ignored me.
Were you living here or Canada
no.
at the time?
This was in Palo Alto.
Okay. The local university.
The local community college. Right. And, you know, and one of them said yes. And so mm-hmm. I showed up wet behind the ears and just stuck with it. And, you know, I wasn't smart enough to leave. So.
Oh, wow. And 2 weeks in, you knew. Yeah. Like, you're having so much fun.
I was having so much fun.
That's awesome.
And that's really what I've gravitated towards was having fun. So everything that I've done since is just some self-expression of enjoyment. Yeah.
Your brother Andrew also has 1 foot in science. Older brother, right?
I have two brothers, but okay. This one is my older brother.
Okay, that's what I thought. He's got a triple degrees in neuro, biochem, NCHEM,
and a minor in math.
Yeah, who's counting? And then his other foot's in tech as the co-founder of an AI startup. He's also known for starting college at age 12.
I was the dumb son, the slow reader in the family.
Yeah. you mentioned you were homeschooled until college and you lived in a bunch of different places growing up. How have those experiences shaped, you know, both of you to some degree to your success? Like,
yeah, probably a lot to mm-hmm. a degree that I'll use my, you know, AI therapist to unpack someday. you know, I think it taught me a lot of independence, right? Because you don't actually know when you're going through something like this how weird it is or how unusual it was. Like,
it's just normal for you, right?
It's just normal for me. This is all.
When you got to college, didn't you realize something was a little different?
I knew definitely before then, but it's one thing to intellectually know something, and it's another to
emotionally
and socially feel it.
Okay.
Right. But yes, when you're half the size of everybody else, it's pretty clear something's wrong. Right. But you know, you're also used to that.
Yeah.
But you know, the thing that I learned was, you know, you can just do stuff and you can do it by yourself without all of these other people saying yes or being around you. And probably a lot of the things that I've done since that feel unusual come from learning probably very early in life that that's okay and that I can be comfortable and survive in those environments when I'm not, you know, not in the crowd. Yeah.
So you do grow and become independent through those experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, early childhood education is another kind of academic interest. And
do you think more people should homeschool their kids?
I think there should be more alternative models, just like ARC is not saying ARC is the best model and there should just be lots more ARCs. We're just saying there should be a reasonable alternative to the dominant system.
Yeah.
And I think similarly in education, I think we require it, basically.
Are there any aspects of your childhood that you would replicate with your kids someday?
Absolutely. No, I'm going to be running lots of experiments.
Yeah. Moving around, homeschooling?
Pod schooling is potentially
something okay.
I'm interested in. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's close things out with some advice for the community.
If I have any to give. It's worth as much as they're paying for it.
How How should scientists be preparing differently today when it comes to a career in academia or industry? Like if you were starting grad school again today or starting, you know, first year as an industry scientist, like what advice would you give yourself?
I think there's the first thing that I've learned in research that's extremely surprising and puzzling is the amount of effort and time it takes to solve a high impact problem and a low impact problem are pretty similar.
This is like what people say about starting like a company with a really big ambitious mission or like a company with like a smaller, less
they're
ambitious.
Equally hard.
Yep.
Right. So pick the high impact problem.
Mm. Yeah. 'Cause it's going to be just as painful.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the funny thing. You don't know any of this stuff until later when it's too late. Right. Right. That's a weird thing about advice.
Yeah. Wisdom can't be taught, only learned. Cool. Should we do our lightning round questions?
Let's go for it.
All right. So rapid fire. Answer quickly in a few words. Don't think about it too much. No wrong answers. Just say whatever comes to mind first. You can wave your wand and have a cure for anything. What would it be?
Alzheimer's.
What's something about you that people would be surprised to learn?
I'm very fun.
What's your superpower?
My compass.
Compass?
I have this deep internal sense of the right direction to point. Mm. Right. Yeah.
I like that. What are you terrible at, either professionally or out in your personal life?
I'm surprisingly bad at directions.
Oh.
Like actually my macro navigation skills are atrocious.
The inner compass is strong.
Yeah, exactly. There are trade-offs everywhere. You got to break the trade-offs though.
It's better to be spiky. What's something you're obsessed with as a child?
Medieval history.
Oh, I didn't know that about you. What is the best book you've read this year?
Deep Learning.
It's a textbook. Okay.
Maybe that's an embarrassing answer.
No, respect. Who should we interview next?
Oh my gosh. Who should we interview next? Jay Bhattacharya.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a name. I thought you were going to say Fung for sure.
Oh, really? Ooh. That would be great.
Yeah. Has your perm made you more approachable to your trainees?
Maybe too
approachable. Too approachable.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. But hey, you got to have fun.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you. It was a joy.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.